good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 594 of Unwelcome Guests, Occupy 2.0. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're returning to the Occupy movement to share a range of perspectives and thoughts on where that's going. This is the third program that we've had on Occupy, and I continue to be encouraged by it. I only follow the independent, non-commercially controlled reports. I suspect it's had a bit of a drubbing in newspapers and television. We're going to hear Noam Chomsky's reports on press coverage, which he says has been mixed. We're also going to hear from Peter P. theorist Michael Bowens on his interpretation, which I hope you'll find as interesting as I did. He's talking about peer-to-peer value creation, collaborative consumption, and open-source manufacturing. I mean, these are big words, and basically it amounts to an alternative way of doing business. Ways of making things which are centered on sharing, centered on what can we provide for other people, as opposed to centered on what can we persuade other people to hand over to us. Rather a large difference on matters like engineered obsolescence, which is a plus if you're in the command economy, you're trying to maximize people's consumption of your products, but is fairly much a minus as far as collective humanity goes. Engineering products to go wrong or to have limited lifespans, not a good thing. So we're going to return to a familiar perspective, thinking about humanity as a whole. How could we understand what is Occupy? Why would hundreds of thousands of people worldwide be camped outside when they have homes to go to? And why would other people try and make life difficult for them, whether it's ripping up their tents, spraying poisonous chemicals in their face, trying to cause them pain? Why would people do that to other people? From humanity's point of view, that seems like a fairly crazy thing. Well, this is kind of the social equivalent of what goes on in your body if you have an autoimmune disease. If there are cells in your body busy trying to kill other cells in your body that actually should be there, not fighting off invaders, but it's a kind of civil war. The defenses of your body are turned against itself, and in the same way, the forces of law and order, the police force, which is nominally there to protect the well-being of everybody and keep harmony and keep peace in society, they're actually provoking. We know there's been agents provocateurs. They're going out causing trouble, and yes, they're using up lots of resources as they do it, putting people's belongings into the crusher. Why would they do that? Well, we know there's certain commercial incentives. People want to fill up private prisons. People make money selling poisonous chemicals. The powers that be want to keep business as usual. They want to keep the perpetual consumption train on the rails for as long as they can, and we know that that's not going to go on forever, but it's the short-term thinking. I think that if we live a few more years, we will look back on Occupy as the rumblings of a momentous change when people gave up a selfish perspective and embraced something that was much closer to their hearts, not perhaps closer to their pocketbooks, not perhaps inspired by the brainwashing that most people have had to endure, by which I mean school and training in business, life as usual, if you can apply that word to the system of consumerism, which is promulgated so vociferously and vehemently, particularly by corporations. We're going to look back on Occupy as part of a seed change in which it became clear not only to activists and intellectuals but to the man and woman in the proverbial street just what insanity is going on in the name of preserving the system as usual. The ecological chickens are coming home to roost, And whilst the rules, as drafted by the bankers, say that the bankers' interests must be protected at all times, ever larger proportions of the population are saying enough is enough. The change with which I most clearly identify is the abandonment of centrally issued currency. But I think this is only one of many changes across the board which are coming, like it or not. And whilst the commercially controlled media tends to put forward a kind of straitjacket perspective on social change, which says, no, basically this doesn't happen anymore because we're in charge and we have the perfect system worked out, I think the apparent suddenness of the Occupy movement going global are showing the lie in a very direct way. The same way that if you happen to live near an Occupy and you go there personally, your eyes and ears may tell you very different things from what a slanted media perspective would have you believe. So Occupy in that sense has been effective at communicating to many people just how much they're being lied to by the corporate machine. Wikipedia, if that's to be believed, informs me that most of the large Occupies, the protest camps, have been demolished by the powers that be that didn't want to tolerate such open dissent. Now, the precise legal grounds for doing this have probably been manifold and varied, if they've even been present. I suspect that plenty of the evictions have been themselves illegal, but I think, technicalities aside, the message has not been lost on general population, which is that ordinary people, without using violence, without threatening to damage any property, are seen as a threat which will be eliminated by force if necessary. So in that sense, the Occupy movements have already succeeded in clarifying that nation-states and accompanying big business claim the right to use force, if necessary, to prevent open dissent. Now, as we shall hear from Chomsky later on this hour, the experience of people living together, what he calls a real community, people who are caring about one another, say more than the occasional hi because they're living close together and because they need one another, is in itself a powerful form of resistance from ordinary people who so often are living what Chomsky calls atomized lives. I think it's hard from a Bangladeshi perspective to understand just how lonely many people in the so-called rich countries have become. Now let's hear an open letter to the Seattle police force by an occupier, Reverend Rich Lang. Now, I've edited this recording for brevity because it uses a citizen's mic. I didn't really think we'd need to listen to it everything twice. The original, as usual, is available for download from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/594. Thank you to Mike McCormack of Mind Over Matters for recording this in November last year.
This is an open letter.
This is an open letter.
To the police department. I'll send it to you. I hope you circulate it. I'll send it to you, Ted. We are not your enemy. You are not our enemy. We are neighbors. We are fellow citizens. We go to the same schools, shop in the same stores, worship in the same faith communities, drill to the same sports teams. That's right. We agonize with the Seahawks. We mourn the Mariners. But we live with hope. We drank in the same bars, except for me. We're even rooted in the same extended family by blood and marriage. But something has gone terribly wrong. The system is turning us into enemies. I believe that the vocation of policing no longer supports police. Instead, you are being militarized and trained to think that the patriotic voice of dissent is a threat that you must contain and at times suppress. You're being trained to use chemical warfare against your fellow citizens. You're being trained to provoke and bully and agitate fellow citizens. Trained to think we want to hate you and harm you. I have been a witness to this. I was singled out by you, alone, full clergy vestments. There was a clear separation between the police line and the marchers who had fled the spray. Six of you singled me out, soaked my albs, turned to me, walked up to me, one officer did, sprayed me full on in the face. That's not courage, and that's not right. But that's not true that we hate you. And it is not true that we want to harm you. We are not here to destroy property. We are not here to hurt people. We are not here because we just love waking up and sleeping and living outdoors in the rain and in the cold. We're here because we want a better life for ourselves and for you. We're all under stress. You too are one pay cut away from deep hurt. You're one layoff away from despair and anger. One collective bargaining, union busting political policy away from powerlessness and hopelessness. That's why we're your circle of protection. We're no different. But the young among us have already been sacrificed to the god of the free market and its doctrine of surplus labor. The young have already had their future foreclosed. What will become of your children? Do you think your baton and gun and handcuffs and spray cans, your nets and surveillance will protect them? Do you think you can secure them? Stop hating us. Stop seeing us as your enemy. Join us. Treat us with respect. We will treat you with respect. Happened last night as proof.
Happened last night as proof.
Happened on our walk down here as proof. Don't obey orders to hurt or harass us. Don't submit to cruelty and brutality. Don't commit treason against your neighbors. Now look around. We might not look like much, but we are the winning side of history. And we invite you to join that because we believe liberty and justice for all. We believe in America's promise of equal opportunity. We believe in the social common good. We believe in live.
We believe in live.
And let live.
And let live.
We believe we are.
We believe we are.
Each other's welfare.
Each other's welfare.
So come and join us.
So come and join us.
Walk with us.
Walk with us.
Not against us.
Not against us.
Together, let us role model.
Together, let us role model.
Hope for our country.
Hope for our country.
Especially in times of stress.
Especially in times of stress.
Hope for our future.
Hope for our future.
Hope that this night will pass.
Hope that this night will pass.
And a new dawn.
And a new dawn.
Will most surely come.
Will most surely come.
For us all.
For us all.
We really want to love you.
We really want to love you.
Do you want to love us?
Do you want to love us?
Let's act like that.
Let's act like that.
Amen.
Amen.
Good to hear the word love there, a word that Bengalis talk about a lot, but which seems to have vanished from certain areas of English dialogue. Doesn't feature, of course, in economics. Caring for other people doesn't feature in economics. And yet, in our heart of hearts, isn't it one of the most important emotions? Perhaps the ultimate important emotion. Something which binds us together, something which gives us meaning. Now, I have a theory that most of the time, just as you choose to be with the people that you love, you will end up loving the people that you choose to be with. How does this relate to capitalism? A lot of people in their 9-to-5 existence don't have a choice about who they want to be with or where they want to be. They are ordered around. That, I think, has a deadening effect on people's love life, by which I don't mean their sex life, and that is something that the Occupy movements have been effective at resisting. People have found, I think, a great lift just from defying public convention about where they should be or why, and sharing the fact that they have a common interest, which is more important than the capitalist society's dictates. If companies are going to claim the right to basically kick people out of wherever they feel like people are in the way, a kind of hyper-privatization of the commons, not only are they going to put a wall around land saying, you're not allowed to farm here, they want to say, you're not even allowed to be here if we don't want you here. These streets and these roads are only for use by workers, not for use by people trying to change society. So not only private property, but previously public property is being annexed, or at least that is what Occupy is showing to be an ongoing process. Framing of we are the 99% is a brilliant way to sidestep the programmed differences of people in self-identity in terms of gender or class or nation or other such divide and conquer strategies, and also to show the lie to the claim that the US or other such countries are democracies, so
you will get the government you deserve. So you're not allowed to complain if they do things you don't like. 99% of people want something and it still doesn't happen, then do they have a right to change the system? Well, according to documents such as the US Constitution and a lot of established practices, yes. A small elite using violence to impose their system, called a tyranny, is fairly much against the rules in any system. Now that's not accidental. That brings us back to love, the idea of live and let live, the golden rule, as a general guiding principle that has got a track record even longer than that of money and doesn't lend itself to the exploitation of the majority of humanity and the world in general by a psychopathic elite. And now we're going to hear a section of an audio produced by InterOccupy. This is a discussion of Occupy movements globally, and we're not actually going to hear the discussion, although that's available for download from this show's webpage. We're going to hear the interview with Noam Chomsky about the Occupy movement and its media coverage, where it could be going. This is from a couple of weeks ago. Thank you to InterOccupy for organizing this.
The Occupy movement is in its second phase, and three of our main goals are to, one, occupy the mainstream and transition from the tents and into the hearts and minds of the masses, two, hard block the repression of the movement by protecting the 99% freedom of assembly, and speak without being violently attacked, and three, in corporate personhood. These three goals overlap and, of course, are interdependent. We're interested in learning what your position is on the mainstream filtering, the repression of civil liberties, and money in politics as it relates to Occupy and the future of America. Shalom, and thank you, sir.
And thank you. Well, the first question has to do with the coverage of Occupy. It's been mixed. I mean, at first it was dismissive and making fun of people playing games and silly kids and so on. But it changed. In fact, one of the really remarkable, almost spectacular successes of the Occupy movement is that it simply changed the entire framework of discussion of many issues. I mean, there were things that were sort of known, but kind of in the margins, hidden, which are now right up front, like the imagery of 99% and 1%, the dramatic facts of sharply rising inequality over the past roughly 30 years, with wealth being concentrated in a small fraction of 1% of the population has a very heavy impact on the ridiculous maldistribution of wealth, while for the majority, real incomes have pretty much stagnated or sometimes declined, benefits declined, work hours going up, and so on. Now, it's not third world misery, but it's not what it ought to be in a rich society, the richest in the world, in fact, with plenty of wealth around, which people can see, but just not in their pockets. And all of this has been brought to the fore. It's now almost a standard framework of discussion. Even the terminology is accepted. Well, that's a big shift. Meanwhile, the coverage of the Occupy movement itself has been varied. In some places, for example, parts of the business press, there's been a fairly sympathetic coverage occasionally. Of course, the general picture is, why don't they go home and let us get on with their work? Or where's their political program? Or how do they fit into the mainstream structure of how things are supposed to change and so on? And then came the inevitable repression, which, of course, is inevitable. It was pretty clearly coordinated around the country. Some of it was pretty brutal. Other places less so. And there's been a kind of a standoff. Some of the occupations have, in effect, been removed. Others have filtered back in some other form. The media coverage of that, I think, has occasionally some of the things have been covered, like the pepper spray and so on. But a lot of it is just considered, again, sort of, why don't they go away and leave us alone? Well, you know, that's to be anticipated. The question of how to respond to it is the primary way to respond to it is one of the points that you made, reaching out to bring into the general occupation, in a kind of metaphorical sense, bring into it much wider sectors of the population. I mean, there's a lot of sympathy for the goals and aims of the Occupy movement, quite high in polls, in fact, but that's a big step short of engaging people in it. It has to become part of their lives, something they think they can do something about. So it's necessary to get out into communities, and that means not just with a message, but if possible, and this would be hard, to try to spread and deepen one of the real achievements of the movement, which I don't think does get discussed in the media, at least I haven't seen it. One of the main achievements has been to create real functioning communities of mutual support, democratic interchange, care for one another, and so on. This is highly significant, especially in a society like ours, in which people are tend to be very isolated, neighborhoods have broken down, community structures have broken down, people are kind of alone. And there's an ideology which there's a lot of effort to implant. It's so inhuman that it's hard to get into people's heads, but the ideology of you just take care of yourself and forget about anyone else. Extreme version is the Ayn Rand version. Actually, there's been an effort for 150 years, literally, to try to impose that way of thinking on people. You go back to the origins of the Industrial Revolution in eastern Massachusetts in mid-19th century. There happened to be a very lively press run by working people, young women in the factories, artisans in the mills, and so on. They had their own press. It was very lively, very interesting, very widely read, a lot of support. And they were bitterly condemned the way the industrial system was taking away their freedom and liberty and imposing on them a kind of a rigid hierarchical structures that they didn't want. One of their main complaints was what they called the new spirit of the age, gain wealth, forgetting all but self. For 150 years, there's been massive efforts to try to impose the new spirit of the age on people. As I say, it's so inhuman that there's a lot of resistance. And it continues. And one of the real achievements of the Occupy movement, I think, has been to develop a real manifestation of rejection of this in a very striking way, where the people involved are not in it for themselves. They're in it for one another and for the broader society and for future generations. And there are bonds and associations that were formed that if they can persist and if they can be brought into the wider community, I think that would be the real defense against the inevitable repression with its sometimes violent manifestations.
Let me ask you to put a little meat on those bones. How best do you think the Occupy movement should go about engaging communities? What methods should be employed? And would you think it's prudent to actually have space and decentralized basis of operations within, at least in New York City, the five boroughs?
It would certainly make sense to have spaces, whether they should be open public spaces or not, and to what extent they should be is a kind of a tactical decision that has to be, the decisions have to be made on the cases of a close evaluation of the circumstances, the degree of support, the degree of opposition. Different for different places, and I don't know of any general statement. About the methods, you know, people have problems and concerns, and if they can be helped to feel that these problems and concerns are part of a broader movement of people who support them and who they support, then it can take off. And there's no simple way of doing it, single way of doing it. There's no answer. You might go into a neighborhood and find that their concerns are something maybe as simple as a traffic light on the street where kids cross to go to school, or maybe have prevent people from being tossed out of their homes on foreclosures, or try to develop community-based enterprises, not at all inconceivable. Enterprises owned and managed by the workforce and the community, which can then overcome the choice of some remote multinational and board of directors made out of banks to shift production somewhere else. These are real, very live issues happening all the time, and it can be done. Actually, a lot of it is being done in scattered ways, and a whole range of other things, depending on police brutality, civic corruption, media. The reconstruction of media that come right out of the communities is perfectly possible. They didn't have some genetic difference in the mid-19th century that enabled people to have a live media system of a community-based, sometimes ethnic-based, labor-based, many other groupings. All of that can be reconstructed. It takes work, and it can bring people together doing these things together. Actually, I've seen things done in various places, which are models that could be followed. I'll just give you one example. I happened to be in Brazil a couple of years ago, and I was spending some time with Lula, the former president. This is actually before he was elected president. He was a labor activist, an activist, and so on. We traveled around some together. One day he took me out to a suburb of Rio. The suburbs in Brazil, and like in most places, are where the poor people live. The rich people live downtown. So the suburbs are the big poor areas, they don't have very much, millions of people. We went out there. We took me out one evening when they were having it's semi-tropical, so people are outside a lot, and this big public square. Well, what was happening was that a small group of professionals, media professionals from the town, came out regularly, put up a truck in the middle of the square. This is 9 o'clock at night, prime TV time, but a lot of people are milling about. They put up a truck. They had a screen above it, and on the screen, they presented skits, plays, written by people in the community, acted by people in the community. They were on pretty serious. Some of them were kind of, for fun. Others were quite serious about debt, about AIDS, about quite serious matters. As I say, written by and acted by local people, mostly pretty young people. And as people gathered around in the square, some of the actors, of course, everyone knows each other. Some of the actors walked around with mics, asking people to comment on the material that had been presented. They were filmed commenting on it, so that was shown on the screen. Other people could see it. Other people reacted. Maybe somebody sitting in a small bar nearby or walking around the streets. And in no time, you had quite interesting interchanges and discussions among people about quite serious topics that are part of their lives. Well, if it can be done in a poor area, in a Brazilian slum, we can certainly do it in better ways in many places. But I think these are the kinds of, I'm not suggesting you duplicate exactly that, but these are the kinds of things that can be done to engage broader sectors and help them, give them a reason to feel that they can be part of this too. And if that extends substantially enough with the formation of communities and the development of very of serious programs adapted to whatever people's needs happen to be, could be anything from very simple things up to starting to create a new socioeconomic system with worker and community-owned enterprises. A whole range of things are possible, and I don't think there's any particular formula as to how you go about doing it ever, any more than there was, has been in any other popular movement. But with a little imagination and initiative and engagement, I think many such possibilities are opened up. And that's the best means of defense. The more active public support there is, the better defense there is against repression and violence.
Okay. I want to come back, bring back Mikhail, the third facet of Mikhail's questions regarding getting money out of politics. How would you go about dealing with such a daunting task? And can you see that happening as an extension of the community involvement and engagement that you were just talking about?
Well, getting money out of politics is a very crucial matter. It has been for a long time. It's gotten much more extreme now. I mean, it's now at the point where elections for a long time have just been public relations extravaganzas, where people are kind of mobilized to get excited every 4 years and push a button and go home and forget about it. There's a lot of ways to go about overcoming that. Some of them reach as far as organizing for constitutional conventions, say to take away corporate personhood. That's far-reaching. We're not anywhere near that. But there are a bunch more short-term things that are possible. Like we happen to be in the primary system, a primary period right now. Well, the way primaries are carried out in the United States, and this is just taken for granted, is radically undemocratic. What happens is, say New Hampshire primary, first one, candidates show up, come to a town, a lot of publicity, a lot of ads and so on, a lot of hoopla. Maybe they rent a hall or something. And then they tell the people in the town, here's who I am, here's what I'm going to do. And, of course, they never say anything much. Vote for me. And if they do say anything, nobody has a reason to believe them. It's possible to imagine a Democratic primary. I don't mean the Democratic Party. I mean done democratically. How would it be done in a functioning democracy? Well, the people in the town would get together, have town meetings, discussions, and come up with some ideas about what they think ought to be done in the locality, in the country, foreign policy, the whole range. And then they would say, well, if you want to come and you tell the candidate, but first of all, they might just pick their own candidates. Or if there are national candidates running, they could say, you can come to visit us if you like, but we don't want to hear speeches from you. We're going to tell you what we think policy ought to be. And if you can convince us that you'll accept these policies and carry them forward, then maybe we'll vote for you. I mean, either that or direct representation coming out of the communities would be a democratic alternative to the kind of farcical system that we simply take for granted. Well, these are ways of, right from the ground, and there are many other possibilities of getting money out of politics. There are broader ways which involve legislation and so on. And those these things are not in conflict with one another. There's a lot of ways of going about the same ends. And it's a very critical part. You don't really have, it's not just elections. I mean, things have reached a point in the United States where even within Congress, if someone wants a position of a degree of power and authority, they literally have to buy it. It used to be that being chair of a committee, say, was granted by the parties on the basis of seniority, service, and other factors. Now, you literally have to pay the party to be a candidate for a chair. Well, that has an effect, too. It drives members of Congress also into the same corporate pockets, just if they want to get anywhere. Again, this is not 100%, but these are pretty widespread tendencies, and they're tending to fragment, to shred whatever's left of functioning democracy. You can see it in the campaigns, which are just farcical.
Let me ask you, considering that the movement began with a relatively large dose of anarchist inspiration, how do you think we can best recapture the meaning of that term in society and dispel all the various stereotypes that exist?
Well, to dispel the stereotypes, you have to be doing something concrete and constructive that people can identify with. So, in fact, the what I mentioned before, the development of kind of spontaneous development of communities of mutual support and democratic participation, that's something that people can comprehend and can consider to be of value for themselves, which they can maybe develop in some other way in their own communities. That's the only way to get rid of stereotypes and also even to develop your own conceptions, our own conceptions of what a meaningful kind of true system of liberty and freedom and a mutual aid would be like. You learn these things by doing them. And others will be brought in to the extent that they see something valuable in it.
We're now, as everybody knows, we're coming into an election season, and the movement to date has been dependent on external sources of funding and to various degrees. By the election, the party's profit, mainly the Democratic Party, lurking in the background. How do you assess the goals of the Democratic Party as far as co-opting the movement, and what should we be vigilant in looking at? And as much.
Well, each of the two parties, such as they are, actually I should say the Republicans have, even many years ago, have abandoned much of a pretense of being a traditional political party. They are so uniformly and with such dedication committed to tiny sectors of power and profit that they're hardly a political party anymore. And they have to have a catechism they have to repeat in lockstep unity, kind of like a caricature of the old Communist Party. They have to do something to get a voting constituency, because you can't get that from the 1%, the huge industry. So they've been mobilizing sectors of the population that were already always there, but not particularly politically organized very well. Religious evangelicals, nativists who are terrified that their country's being taken away from, their rights are being taken away, a lot of small businesses involved. I mean, I hate to say it, but if you look at it historically, it's not unlike the demography that was organized by the Nazis and the big industrialists who supported them. It didn't turn out very pretty. And they're kind of stuck on that. It's almost a necessary step once they've abandoned any pretense of working for the interests of the population. The Democrats are a little bit different. They have different constituencies. They're following along pretty much the same path. So the centrist Democrats of today, the ones who essentially run the party, they're pretty much the moderate Republicans of a generation ago. They've been kicked out of the Republican Party. They now are kind of the mainstream of the Democrats. And they're going to try to organize and to mobilize, co-opt, if you like, their constituency. That's the Democrats, interestingly, have pretty much abandoned the white working class. It's rather striking to see. So that's barely part of their constituency at this point, which is a pretty sad development. But they will try to mobilize elements of the Hispanics, blacks, what are called progressives of various kinds. They'll try to reach out to the Occupy movements. The organized labor is, still part of the Democratic constituency. They try to co-opt them. And with Occupy, it's just the same as all the others. The political leadership will try to say, pat you on the head and say, yeah, I'm for you, vote for me. And the people involved have to understand that maybe they'll do something for you, but only if you maintain substantial pressure. You can get elected leadership to do things, but they're not going to do it on their own, with very rare exceptions. They're subject to other pressures. As far as money in politics is concerned, it's hard to beat the comment of the great political financier Mark Hanna about a century ago. He was asked what was important in politics. He said there are three things important in politics. The first is money. The second is money. And I've forgotten what the third one is. That was a century ago. It's by now much more extreme. So yes, a concentrated wealth will of course try to use its wealth and power to take over the political system as much as possible, to run it, to make sure it does what they want, etc. It'd be kind of like a miracle if they didn't. The public has to find ways to struggle against that. And it can. Centuries ago, political theorists like David Hume, famous, one of his foundations of government, pointed out correctly that power is in the hands of the governed, those who are governed, not the governors. And that's true whether it's a feudal society or a military state or, nothing much in the way of a functioning parliamentary democracy at the time he wrote, but there too. Power is in the hands of the governed. The only way the rulers can overcome that is by control of opinion and control of attitudes. We're now mid-18th century. And he was right, and it remains true. The power is in the hands of the general population. There are massive efforts to control it, less by force today than there used to be, because a lot of rights have been won, which makes force less efficacious. So by other means, propaganda, consumerism, stirring up ethnic hatreds and so on, all kinds of ways. Sure, that's always going to go on and have to find ways to resist it. Same with being co-opted. I mean, there's nothing wrong with supporting, giving tentative support to a particular candidate as long as that person's doing what you want. But it's not, it would be a more democratic society if representatives were also recallable, without huge effort. Well, they're not, but there are other ways of pressuring candidates to do things, and many would do it willingly. It's a fine line between doing that and being co-opted, mobilized to serve someone else's interests. But those are just constant decisions and choices that have to be made.
real quickly, could you speak a little bit about Antonio Gramsci, about how his ideas relate to the things you've been talking about?
I like Gramsci. He's an important person, but he talked about he talked about things not unlike what David Hume was saying, how a cultural hegemony is established by systems of power. I personally think that it's worth reading, but at least when I read it, it simply says well what we more or less know, I think. I don't find anything very novel, or maybe my inadequacy. You read it and see what you think.
Great deal of our economics is dominated by ideas of growth and an incredible fixation, constant growth, more and more and more. How do you assess our reliance economically on the constant expansion and those fixations broadly within the society?
Well, we are. I mean, the whole human species at the moment is facing a very serious problem of whether even decent existence can be carried forward. We're kind of coming close to the edge of a precipice on environmental destruction. Now, if growth is understood to mean constant, to carry with it constant attacks on the physical environment that sustains life, like, for example, greenhouse emissions or destruction of agricultural land or so on and so forth. If that's what it means, we are like lemmings walking over a cliff. But that isn't what growth has to mean. For example, growth might mean simpler lives in more livable communities. That takes work. It doesn't just come by itself. It takes labor. It takes a development, but of a different kind, oriented towards different goals than simply having more consumer goods in your pocket. And I think functioning free communities like the Occupy communities can be working towards and developing for themselves and spreading to others is just a different way of living, which is not based on maximizing consumer goods, but in maximizing values that are important for life. That's growth too, just growth in a different direction.
All right, our present crisis, the most recent one, the real estate bubble. Can you talk about that, how we got to this point in terms of a historical context and why you think it occurred and what is really at the root of its occurrence?
Well, at the root of its occurrence is the major shift in the economy that began to take place in the 70s, really escalated radically under Reagan, Thatcher in England, and then on from there. If you go back, there was a big growth period in the United States, the greatest growth in history. It's the 50s and the 60s. And at that time, it was also egalitarian. So the lowest sector, the lowest quintile did about as well as the upper quintile. And it absorbed into the mainstream society groups that had been excluded. African Americans, for example, had been pretty much excluded for centuries, literally. So some of them could get integrated into society. That came to an end at the end of the 60s. In the 70s, starting in the mid-70s, there was a very substantial shift. For one thing, there was a shift towards increasing the role of finance in the society. Finance is one of the great financial economists just wrote recently that the financial systems are wiping out functioning markets the way a larva eats away at its host and destroys it. He's one of the most respected financial economists in the world, incidentally, not a radical. That's what the effect of the financial systems has been. Now, also combined with this was corporate decisions to shift production abroad. It's not a law of nature, again. You can have decent working conditions and production at home, but they made more profit that way. These decisions greatly changed the economy. And that's
I didn't understand your question. What was that?
But let me just go back to your last question about the housing bubble, which I'm sort of building up to slightly, too slowly. Anyway, one effect of this was that wealth became extremely concentrated heavily in financial industries, and that led to concentration of political power, leads to legislation, so on and so forth, which keeps the vicious cycle going. And part of that was deregulation. During the 50s and the 60s, the great growth period, banks were regulated. There were no crises, no major bubbles had burst. Starting in the 80s, you started getting financial crises, bubbles. There were several during the Reagan administration. The Clinton administration ended with a huge tech bubble that burst. There's a lot of money floating around, real production of what people need. And one of the ways in which households were able to survive during the period of stagnation was just by getting caught up in bubbles. Early in this century, the housing prices started to shoot up way beyond the trend. There is a kind of a trend line of about a century. Housing prices kind of roughly matched gross domestic product. About 10 years ago, they just started shooting way out of sight. No fundamentals. A lot of it was essentially robbery. The prime, subprime mortgages, slicing up complicated devices by which the banks could slice up the mortgage so that others would be have the responsibility when it collapsed, complicated derivatives, other financial instruments. All of this took off, created a huge bubble. It was obviously going to burst. It was barely even noticed by almost the entire economics profession, including the Federal Reserve. The minutes of the 2006 Federal Reserve meetings just came out recently. You may have seen them. And rather strikingly, there was no recognition there that there's a multi-trillion dollar housing bubble that has no basis whatsoever and is going to collapse. In fact, they were congratulating themselves on how marvelously they're running the economy. Well, of course, it collapsed as it had to. Maybe $8 trillion of paper wealth lost for much of the population. That's all they had. Like for African Americans, net worth, what you actually own is what you actually have, the capital you have, that's reduced to practically nothing. And for many others, too. So, of course, it's a disaster. And that kind of thing is going to happen as long as you have unregulated capital markets, which furthermore have a government insurance policy. Credit agencies already, when they rate a company, say Goldman Sachs, they take into account the fact that it's going to be rescued by the taxpayer next time it goes bust. Well, that, of course, increases risk even further. And if it won't be housing, it'll be something else. Commodities or whatever. It's a financial casino instead of a productive economy. And, of course, the people who get hurt are not the rich and powerful, the 99%.
Now, one dimension that tends to be lacking from traditional economic analyses, people looking at the so-called financial crisis, measuring it in its own terms, looking at things like money supply or government debt or other such key statistics, they're missing the point that behind it is the very real ecological crisis. Resources, as they refer to them, have been depleted to the extent that they can't keep doing business the way they're doing business. Now, yes, the current economic logic says, therefore, we need austerity for the 99% who are powerless. Well, if you buy into those models, those assumptions, then yeah, that is the recipe. And a lot of the established figures are unable to think about systemic change. They can't get out of the box that their life experience has put them in. Our next speaker, Michel Bouwens, is one who certainly can. He started a group called the Peter P. Foundation, which is looking at new models of social organization, less hierarchical ones. And whilst it has quite a heavy technological focus, he's certainly not ignoring new models of social organization, new models of decision making, which are enabled by modern technology and social developments such as Occupy. And this is from a couple of weeks ago.
We've spoken a lot about Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
As an expression of much of the work that you do. So why don't we start with if you can maybe give a quick overview of what your perspective is, you know, in terms of, you know, the network age that we live in, and then let's see how we can apply that to Occupy Wall Street.
Okay, well, you know, the first thing I want to say is when you mentioned the concept of P2P revolution, that's really what it means. So in other words, I'm convinced that peer production, it's an emergence of a new way of creating value, of governing ourselves and of protecting our common work, is a prefiguration of a new mode of production and a new type of society. And we've seen it emerging in many, many pockets in agriculture, in finance, you know, in different ways. A lot of local communities are, or even global communities, are practicing peer production. But we needed a mass social movement, and that's something we didn't have, because even 19th century labor movements, and this, I'm not saying this to belittle them, I'm just saying this to show that they come from a certain age and a certain type of society, which has, you know, determined their logic and their ways of thinking. Then we have in the 60s the identities movement, and then I think the other globalization movement for me is a bit of a bridge movement between those two movements. But I think that the Occupy Wall Street is different. It's the first native movement of the digital age, which goes beyond the kind of activist organizations that were present in the other globalization movements, and it really attracts a new layer of the general population, and especially young people, very diverse group, but also very much kind of an expression of, you know, what our life experience is today and what kind of forms we need today to make sense of our lives. And so it's a kind of the mass movement that a lot of people, including me, were waiting for. And so now that it's there, we're very happy, because this is really the tipping point we were waiting for. And so the issue is double. One is that Occupy Wall Street itself exemplifies what we talk about. So it's kind of a prefigurative movement. And I'd like to explain that in a few words, you know, how we see this. But then the other thing is that we need to combine Occupy Wall Street as the emerging mass movement of resistance with what we already know about the emergent productive communities that already apply peer production in their lives. And for me, the answer to the, you know, to actually change our society will come when we can have a convergence between productive publics and mass social movement. And I think the conditions are getting ready to arrive. It's going to be hard work, you know, but because there's two types of different people, really. You have people who feel compelled to resist, you know, put their bodies on the line, and in a resistance movement, right? But you also have people who, for reason of personality or personal choice, are much more drawn to actually doing things right now and have a more difficult time imagining themselves, you know, in this kind of acute struggle situations, right? But they're complementary, and this is what we need to understand. We need to find out how to combine both types of energies in a productive unity.